tape number two of an interview with Dr. Robert and Beth Hyatt on the 16th of March, 1977. And I think we're just kind of finishing up a discussion on the computer center and the contribution that has made to the student participation in that particular type of thing. Mrs. Hyatt, when moving onto a campus that we're beginning to regionalize, do you find it difficult, or is it a difficult position to be the president's wife, where there's also a chancellor's wife, in terms of the dynamics of the social situation, or is it relatively easy to move into?
It was relatively easy, actually, because at the time we came, of course, there was a provost and that, not the chancellors, and so the provost had already been used to working with the president and his wife on the campus. So that part wasn't too bad. In fact, the only thing that came up was that since the concept of a statewide system was developed, there was word from the women in Anchorage, and to some extent the women in Juneau, that they wanted to be considered as much as the university women here. And that was very natural. So that I therefore did mention that perhaps I had would try to do what I could for all of them as easily as possible. I meant that I couldn't do as much as Juneau, but perhaps at Anchorage, because I did go down to Anchorage more often. And whatever role I took here, I would try and take in Anchorage. And gave them, through the provost's wife, the position of the advisor for the University Women's Association, because I could not do it in both places. I thought that would be a way to go anyhow, from my point of view, for the women. So I didn't try, that was the only thing. Other than that, I think I made it known that I was there on the campus, and because I was there, and because I was interested very much, so I would like to attend as much as I could and be of any help I could. My house was open whenever I could possibly let them use the house, and I hope to be there if I could be. If not, they could use the house and use the house. And I think they understood that, and I felt that it was quite easy to relate to the campus. Would you like me to go on about the community a little bit?
Sure.
To the community, it was a little more difficult. And I think for this reason, let's say perhaps if the reasons are not simple, it is also a little more complex, as Bob's explanation of developing a statewide system was somewhat complex. For the same reason, relating to the Fairbanks women was a problem in that for Fairbanks in general, for the people in Fairbanks in general, to accept the statewide concept was difficult. And therefore, to accept someone who was coming in to change things was difficult. Naturally, the university was here solely at one time, and there was a strong feeling of possession for the university in Fairbanks. Therefore, I think it took longer for me to integrate into the community than it would have had we come up under previous circumstances. But I think it took, it meant relating to them socially, and I would hear of situations where perhaps I could improve it, and I tried. But I wanted to relate to the community activities in my own way, since I do feel that way about doing things that I did in Japan and Hawaii. And finally did hit upon working on a project, which was the Red Cancer Detection Center. And I think that by itself is raising me with the community more than anything else I do.
Maybe you'd like to discuss that for a minute in terms of how you got involved in it and what your participation was.
Yeah, just very briefly, because I realize there's so much else to talk about, but I can just say this, that when I was asked to be on the committee as vice president of the group that was trying to develop it here, I felt, because I had read a great deal about the breast cancer detection centers, I did decide to do that. At least get started and be sure that this is what I wanted to do. And it wasn't long until the president left Fairbanks and I took over. And so with the aid of people here on campus, especially Dr. Wayne Myers, and also with others in the community, and with a board of about seven women at the time, we started working on the basics of any organization that is. In fact, it is the only one of its kind in the United States, I realize now, that all of the others are supported by an American Cancer Society. We knew that. We tried to get in with theirs, but they said, no, theirs was only related to a pilot research program. Therefore, as purely service to a community or communities that we could develop them, this could not be allowed. We could not have funds for any kind of help we wish. So RSN had to go along on its own funds as well as organizations. So that meant, of course, starting out to develop into a corporation, having our bylaws, our articles, our funding, everything. But now it is in full operation, and we're proceeding very much the same way that the American Cancer Society centers are on doing breast cancer detection.
Dr. Height, one of the things that I noticed you were particularly pleased with was the Interagency Fisheries Council, and I was wondering what you saw or how you saw that coming together from the various state agencies and the university.
Well, this had its origin really in the philosophy of making the university relate to Alaska and to Alaskans. I'm sure I'm not telling anybody anything when I say we have the largest fishery potential, the richest fisheries in the nation, practically in the world. Except for a few people working on some other things, the largest number of people are actually still employed in the fisheries in Alaska. And yet I discovered the university wasn't doing one single thing with respect to fisheries. And of course the university is established for education first of all, and without having time myself to get out and do a sort of field study of what it was all about and where we could fit, I engaged a friend of mine by the name of Clinton Atkinson, who was an outstanding fishery man who worked in Alaska many years earlier, to come up and be a consultant to me and to do a study of where the university might best fit itself into the whole fishery program, particularly stressing the educational aspects of the university. So he made this study and indicated the first finding that was the most startling to me, and that was that the Alaska Division of Fish and Game, which employs I don't know how many hundred fishery biologists, didn't have a single one from the University of Alaska, not a single person. All of them were imported, were 48. Well, that made me more interested than ever in getting moving on this sort of thing. So we developed a plan for fishery education, and we felt that it would do very little good to develop a plan for fishery education unless the policymakers in the state Division of Fish and Game, and in the federal National Marine Fisheries Group, they were the big employers of fishery scientists, fishery technicians. It wouldn't do little good to do much of anything unless they were willing to cooperate and to, in effect, employ our people and so on once they were trained. So I talked with Jim Brooks, who is a graduate of the University of Alaska and the commissioner for Division of Fish and Game, and also with Mr. Harry Reitz, who is the head of this region for the National Marine Fisheries Service, the federal program, and discussed the possibility of maybe just having a policy level informal group meet in order to kind of pool our information, our interests, what we were doing, and so on, with the special advantage the university of permitting us to determine what kind of people need to be trained, that is, in what particular technical areas, what programs our graduate students might engage in that fit directly into the requirements that they had for information needed for fishery management in the state. So they thought it was a good idea, too. And we then, the three of us, representing the head of a major agency, met and decided that we should also invite a representative from the governor's office in order to get that support going, and also a representative of the legislature. So we asked the governor to name a person, and he did. And we talked to the legislative leaders, and they suggested that the chairman of the Senate Resources Committee should be the one. So these five people now have been meeting for over 2 years. We meet about three times a year and indicate what our programs are. The person in the legislature indicates what's in the hopper legislatively or what should be. Governor's office person is there just to kind of get a feeling for what's going on. And we've developed analyses of the research programs going on in the state and the federal agencies. We know how many graduate students they would like to have, how many they're willing to support with fellowships and that sort of thing. And as a result of this, we then went ahead and developed our fishery educational program, which in effect utilizes the whole state system to support it. As I mentioned earlier, at one time we had a fishery technology program at Kodiak, which is the center of the principal fishing fleet. That's where most of our landings occur and where our fleet is stationed. These people are involved in two aspects, one in fish processing, because that's where the processing plants are as well, and one in simple fishing, not how to fish, but how to take care of your vessel, how to repair your motors, how to use new electronic gear, how to keep care of the nets and other fishing gear, safety at sea, navigation, all of the things that we felt that the fishing group ought to know in terms of what they tell us that they would like to know, we put into this fishery technology program. This is run out of the Kodiak Community College. Now, down in Juneau, we decided to establish the fishery science program. That's where we're training people at the baccalaureate level and advanced degree level to go into the fishery investigation area, quite different than doing the fishing or processing. Now, the reason we chose that was that happens to be the headquarters of both the National Marine Fishery Program and the State Fish and Game Division. So they have there an assemblage of very highly qualified people, both of these groups, and particularly the National Marine Fisheries Program has a very fine library and a marine station right almost next to the Auk Lake campus of the university. We have since then purchased land adjacent to them, and the building is now underway for the university's fishery center. So that and the federal center will be side by side. We'll parasitize their library and many of their facilities, and we'll put in some things that they needed that are not in their building, and so we'll work out a nice quid pro quo there, and I'm sure get along beautifully. Well, these things have all come out of this interagency fishery group. We've discussed them, decide, you know, how these are going to work, so on. Right now, we are trying to get a freshwater fishery federal unit on this campus, Fairbanks. We have a wildlife unit. This is the same kind of a unit, but for freshwater fisheries. At the last meeting we had during the end of February of the Interagency Fishery Council, we got the council to endorse this, Fish and Game to endorse it, and the federal program to endorse it. So it's now back in Washington for consideration. But this agency functions totally informally. We have, of course, some of our staff people there when we're presenting certain programs. But we keep it out of politics. It's not open to the press. And I think it's one of the better developments we've had in this state and in the whole fishery industry, because it's really gotten the three major groups together. we don't have the fishery industry itself related to it, because that would immediately get us into other kinds of interests we thought that other councils and so on could take care of better. But that's what that is, and it's all part of our effort to develop education for resource development in this state.
You're talking about the development of the academic development plan, and regionalization, and the development of a statewide system. How would you characterize your style of leadership and direction, the kind of thing you saw the president functioning as, the way you saw the president functioning?
Well, since this was a statewide system, and I was given the job of putting it together, you might say, in a coordinated fashion. Again, I had to think about how the president would function. It's pretty obvious to me, and I think this is almost universal human nature, that people who really are in charge of programs like to feel that, by golly, they are in charge of the program, and they don't want somebody looking over their shoulder every minute to see how it goes. So when we decided to set up these three principal campuses, each with its own chancellor, one of the points I made very strongly was that each chancellor was to be his own man, that so long as he functioned within the policy set down by the regents and the central administration and did their reporting properly to the central administration, they pretty much had a free hand to do what they want to do. And I think Dr. Cutler has pretty much had that on this campus. I certainly don't interfere with it, or didn't interfere with it. I think Chancellor Lindauer on the Anchorage campus has felt quite free. Certainly Dr. Ferguson at the University of Southeast has felt quite free. As a matter of fact, they have so much freedom it's sometimes difficult to get them even to hang on to the policies that the regents have established. But it's better, I feel it's better to have a very high degree of autonomy that way than to have too high a degree of regulation. So I think that would destroy initiative and work against us. So my philosophy is give them their head and go. Now sometimes this backfires, and it has here, but you have to expect that, and I think over time it'll work out for the best.
Do you find it an uncomfortable arrangement to be on the campus with a chancellor that perhaps you're called on by some kind of faculty when they run up the hall and they can play? Or
well, this is an unfortunate arrangement. There's no question about it. When I came here, the faculty and students have been so used to going right to Dr. Wood's office for everything on this campus that they just kept doing that. And even though we had established Errol Beislein as provost, they just went right by his office and came right into mine. And poor Earl was there trying to function as an administrator, yet I think was bypassed a great deal of the time. This is one reason why when we set up the three chancellors, in order to symbolize the fact that the chancellor of the Fairbanks campus was indeed the head of the campus, I put up that swinging gate up in my hallway with a sign on it that this was a statewide system hit. Now, I was criticized for this, but we left it up for several months. But during that period, people did get used to going to Chancellor Cutler's office, and after a while, I had no problems with it. And run. Then I took the gate down. So it is an awkward situation, but one that was set up in such a way that we couldn't do anything about it. Any thought of moving, let's say, any other place, particularly to Anchorage or Juneau, would have blown the community sky high. Even trying to move out of that one building, the Bunnell building, into the old Chapman building, which I thought we ought to do in order to get the statewide system completely away from the campus administration, symbolic separation would be effective, was criticized by a number of people downtown as being the first move to Anchorage. And we were only going to move a few hundred yards across the campus. But so you see how the I think you see how high the feeling was running. Now, if and when the state capital moves, that's where the statewide office ought to be, wherever it is. And that's the way it is in New York and many other states where they set up the statewide system headquarters for the educational program at the Capitol. And when that's done, nobody has any criticism of it. Each campus then has its own individuality and autonomy to a great extent, and I think that's the way it needs to be here. But it'll be some time yet, because it does, when you move, you're talking about moving several dozens of people, and you just don't do that without some money.
Could you characterize the pull you felt as president by the various regions, perhaps Alaska as a provincial, three provinces, and just wondering how you felt this effect in terms of politics or the pull of people or the pull of programs?
Well, other states have had polarization by region. Certainly California did. San Francisco and Los Angeles for many years, having grown up in Northern California, been at the University of California when UCLA was considered a little branch. What we have in Alaska is not unique. It's strong. It'll be stronger, I think, in Alaska for a very long time, largely because of the geographic separation. The Alaska Range is really quite a barrier for some reason. The Southeast, I think, will be an area of sort of steady population and so on. And unless something that's unforeseen happens down there, the development, I think, will not be all that great. But I think Fairbanks will develop as the interior grows in terms of resource development, hopefully someday some kind of utilization of those resources locally, at least adding some value to them before we ship them out. Anchorage is bound to develop, if not for just simple state reasons, for international reasons. It's a very strategically located airfield. And so I think we're going to have these regional concerns, and unfortunately, Anchorage will grow in population, I think, faster than Fairbanks, and the problem will be exacerbated rather than relieved as more and more of the legislature becomes Anchorage-oriented. If the two cities were about the same size, I'd say we'd have a pretty good competitive standoff. They aren't going to be the same size, and therefore I think that the Fairbanksians are going to have to take some route other than trying to fight Anchorage. I don't think they're ever going to win that one. But they've asked me during this last budget session, what can we do to get more money for the Fairbanks campus? I said, well, what you can do is to get more money for the whole system. That'll give more money to the Fairbanks campus. But that's too novel an idea for them. That's just too far out. They can't understand that. But I think that's the way, as I see it, that's the way it's going to have to go. So I think we're always going to have this problem. We're going to have to live with it.
I remember when you first came here, the number of women did talk to you about a daycare center, and you were very supportive. I wonder if you might like to use that as a characterization of the other involvement you might see that you were involved, that you got into.
Yeah, on the campus. Yes, it was purely in the advisory capacity, however, and I didn't do the footwork, let's say, that I did with the breast cancer detection center in the community, but I did advise them and was there to see them at any time and try to research some ideas for them and make some contacts for them during that period. But I would say that the work was done primarily by those who were involved, especially Carol Brinkley, who did the major part.
I think you've been involved with a similar type center in Hawaii, have you not?
No, except on my own. When I was at home. It's a family situation where there was one left at home and I developed my own daycare with a rather primary school development since I had been trained as a teacher for several years. So I think that is what they perhaps had heard and called upon me, whatever I could to help them. But I was most anxious to help, and I had told the women on the campus if I could be able to help in any way, I'd be glad to. Another time I was called on, let's say, to help in relation to my association with Japan. In his lecture series, I mentioned that I had a great deal of work with the book of Japan and was asked if I could make a list of a good bibliography of books that should be in the university library. And I did spend a good deal of time on that, several weeks, and worked out what I hoped was a complete enough list, some of which, of course, the library already had, but others which were new and with which I had become associated while living in Japan. So perhaps those are two of the things. Other than that, it was a matter of just being there when they wanted me and helping whenever I could help with various things University Women wanted to help with.
Dr. Haight, you were mentioning that one of the, by placing power out, the ability to make decisions further out from your office, it was part of your style of governing, but that one aspect that you had difficulty with backfire, was this the financial area that you were thinking of?
No, there are quite a number of areas that backfired somewhat. The financial area really was not a result of that at all. That was primarily right within the central administration and not really a part of the external group. The distribution, or you might say, of decision making or power development in the various units, to a certain extent, made it more difficult to handle the financial problem because we couldn't always get in from these units the information we needed. We couldn't always get them to follow the rules and regulations that had been laid down. And it was very difficult to communicate adequately with them. In other words, extra special efforts had to be made, for example, to get people, say, in Bethel, community college there, to understand how to develop a timesheet and turn in a timesheet and the value of getting that timesheet correct and in time, if they want to get checks back. So these things just took an inordinate amount of time. But these, I think, are system problems. If you're going to be spread out, you have to expect some of these problems. And I don't think that the central administration is really ever staffed up or organized to really get out and do the kind of almost person-to-person communication that was required to solve some of these problems. I tried to do it by memos and telephone calls and so on, but never ever really worked. Even our Anchorage campus was, and perhaps still is, the most difficult to handle in terms of getting in the kinds of things that need to go into the payroll system in order to get checks back accurately. Now, part of this may be due to the fact that they have so many people being hired and terminate down there because of the short course program and so on they have in great abundance. Lots of things of this sort complicate the matters, but a system to run correctly simply has to be manned a lot better than the University of Alaska Central System is. And that's difficult because whenever money is in short supply, and it has been in short supply since I've been here, the usual cry from the campuses is, well, let's not put any in administration, but let's put more into program. And now this is fine, except that you can't just keep doing that and keep doing it and keep doing it and expect to keep up with your support operation. It's like trying to run an army on a battlefield without any backup. You've got a lot of people on the front line, but unless you can keep them supplied, and so you really can't have an effective operation. So what we did was simply get out of balance. We put more money into programs than we did in proportionally we did into support areas, and we should have had these balanced better. There's no question about it. But as I say, it's the human nature to react against that in another accountant in the accountant's office, even though you're not getting your check on time or something of this sort. That's not important. So we did. We got out of balance, and we made this a very strong point in the letter in our covering letter in our budget presentation that we were out of balance. And of course, many of the fiscal problems that have occurred here are because we have been out of balance, and they've been out of balance for years.
The financial situation has obviously caused you a lot of heartbreak and real concern. Maybe you'd like to characterize how, at least in your perception, it began and developed, and what happened.
Paul, I can give you a perception of this. Since it's really a historical thing, I'm not up on it. But when I came here to look over the job and discuss things with the regents and so on, there was never any mention of any financial management problem. Ever. And it wasn't until after I was here about a year and a half or so that I began to detect that we had a problem. Now, a university president usually is selected because he has some kind of academic credentials to lead a university's academic life, not because he has bookkeeping potential or potential to invest the university's money properly in stocks and bonds. I usually leave this up to a vice president or whatever the officer may be called, who's really in charge of the administration of the university, that is, the support functions. Here we call it vice president for finance and controller. So at the end of each year, there would be an auditor's report. I should say first, in all the time I've been here, I've never received one status report yet, not one. This didn't worry me too much at first, because at the end of each year there would be an auditor's report, external auditor's report, and we weren't ever in the red since I've been here. The auditor's report would say you have to, a management letter, you got to do a lot of things differently, or they recommend that you do them differently. But the regents would go over these, and we'd have a session on them, and the vice president for finance would make a few remarks like, yeah, we're working on this, or something. And that's all was ever said. Nobody ever went into it further. So really, it wasn't until we changed computers. In other words, he did come in finally and say, we no longer really can keep up with the load that we are putting now on the computer without getting a new computer in. So we had groups studying this for quite a few months, and finally recommendations were made to us, and we made a selection on the basis of what was presented, at least I did, what was presented to me as the best of the alternatives. Then we ran into serious problems with the payroll. This was even before the new computer was brought online. We were having difficulty getting the checks out. There are an awful lot of hand-paid checks and that sort of thing. And the old program for writing checks and so on was inadequate for the kind of money sources that we had. I couldn't people would get paid from four or five different sources of money, and the computer program wouldn't handle that sort of thing. And so we decided that to shock this whole thing, get a whole new set of systems. And that's when we cast about and had one company come in and review the situation and make recommendations what we ought to do. And we then hired by contract this FCT Corporation to not only to run the computer center, which by and large I think they've done fairly well, but to write the business systems, business management systems, and student management systems that have to go on that computer. Well, when a company like this comes in, you investigate, and we found that they had done fairly well in a couple of other universities, so we weren't too concerned about them, and they dealt only with universities, and we thought this was a good sign. So they started in, and they were going to develop first a general ledger. And I've learned a lot about these bookkeeping terms since I got into this mess that I never knew before. I never knew what the general ledger even was, but that was going to be the basis for the entire financial operation, so they started on that. Well, they no sooner got started than our payroll system broke down. And so we discussed this, whether we should go ahead and try to patch up the old payroll system or whether to change horses in midstream and develop a payroll module, payroll software, first, even before we developed the general ledger. We decided that the payroll was probably the most important single thing that we had in the university in relation to our faculty and staff, because getting a check that's accurate and on time is something that everybody expects. If we couldn't deliver that, we'd be in deep trouble. And so we decided to go with the payroll first. Well, about that time, a decision had been made to go to biweekly pay instead of monthly pay. All of these things just sort of happened at the wrong time. If we'd done them one at a time, we had no problem, but they were done several at a time, and that's where we got into difficulty. When we gave notice about going on biweekly pay, a large number of the faculty objected because it would hit them right in the middle of a contract year. And when you go to biweekly pay, which has a lot of advantages in terms of the administration, and getting checks accurate and that sort of thing, and things in on time, it has the disadvantage that you are always 2 weeks late in getting paid. In other words, there's a lag of 2 weeks in your paycheck. And once you get started on this, it's no great problem, but getting started in the middle of a stream, many people felt they just couldn't do it. To make matters worse, the union had a stipulation in their contract that they got paid monthly, which they had been getting all this time. And so they lodged a grievance against us on the two-week thing. They thought, well, you know, we're getting into such a horrible mess. What we best do is just hold this payroll program off until the 1st of July. That time, everybody would be starting from scratch, and we'd never have any problems. Well, in the context of the concerns at the time, I think these were good decisions. When you look back on them, you can say, well, now, if we hadn't done that, we'd have probably been all right, you see. But the disgruntled faculty probably would have forgotten it in a month or so, and this sort of thing. But at the time that you're beset with these problems, you have to make decisions that relate to how things look. So we got into a series of problems, and that did delay the development of our general ledger, and it delayed the software developments that would give status reports on relation to budget, expenditures, and conferences, and so on, which are needed to bill for federal contract reimbursements. They won't give you the money unless you show you spent it. So this delay ran us about 6 months behind, 6 or 7 months behind getting status reports. Okay, this apparently was known to our business people, but they didn't say anything about it. unfortunately, I didn't know about it until I had a report from Juneau coming by way of our budget officer, who was told about it, that we had drawn practically all of our state funds already, and we were going to be out of money by the middle of April. So I immediately called in Max Hollinger and Bill Froehl, who handles most of the contract, federal contract work, and so on, and I asked if we had a cash flow problem, and Hollinger says, yes, we've got a cash flow problem. Well, it's the first time he'd ever mentioned it. So this had me a little stirred up, because April 15th was only a couple months away at that time, and so I had them prepare a statement as to why we were in a cash flow problem and what we could do, what we thought we could do to get out of it on a time schedule. I had all that, went down to Juneau, talked with the new commissioner, Allen, some of his staff. Allen, in our first discussion, said, well, what really needs a loan to get you by this, a cash flow problem is no great news to me. He said, every state agency has a cash flow problem, and they just draw down against the state. But you see, the university is a body corporate, and they are not allowed to draw against the state treasury. So we'd have to get a loan, and he suggested himself that maybe the best place to get it would be from the teacher retirement system, and let's pay them back. I talked also to others, the legislative leaders, finance, both Senate and House, and to the governor personally about it. And nothing seemed to be, well, they were concerned, but they weren't all that excited, because a cash flow problem is simply cash flow. It's not a matter of being overexpended in the budget at all. Well, in 3 or 4 days after that, there was a series of utterances out of Juneau that the likes of which I hadn't experienced before, about the university being going to be $15 million in debt. And Allen came out with one, said $10 million is what they say, but they're going to be $25 million down, and so on, you know. And by golly, they weren't going to draw anything from that teacher retirement system, because he's going to protect the teachers from that university, you know, and so on. And he was the one who suggested the teacher thing to me. But these kind of things started going, and it wasn't long before it became obvious that this was going to be the issue on which the state government was going to tangle with the regents in terms of who's in control of the university. And that's the issue, not the cash flow problem. Cash flow problem is a simple matter. Auditors, as you know, have been here. They discovered we didn't have $10 million problem. We had an $8 million problem, which is $2 million less than I thought we were having, and certainly not $20 million or $25 million, as Allen led papers to believe. And that they found no, you know, misappropriations or anything of that sort in the thing, just that the accounting was behind. Okay, we knew the accounting was behind. That's no great thing, but we also had a schedule where we were catching up with it. And right now, the information that comes out each day says, you know, well, we're only behind a month, and next month we're going to be current. Well, we had that. That was all written down on the schedule before. Well, anyway, this kicked off what had previously been a sort of a benign antagonism between the state government and the regents. Now, I knew this occurred, and even in my inaugural address, I alluded to the fact that there had been this feeling about who's really going to control the university, the state government, or the regents. And I suggested that we leave it in a benign state. In other words, just not try to solve it, just leave it in that condition. Well, the legislators and the state government, I guess, had other ideas about whether to leave it there or not, and so they pounced on it. I think the regents felt that they might get out of this if they could sacrifice the president, which they did, and but that didn't let them off the hook. So as you will notice now, the state is moving in very strongly on the university's governance, and this is, I think, the most dangerous thing that this university has faced in its whole existence. Because once you control the money and control the institution no longer is going to be able to function like a free university. I think this is unfortunate. I think it was unnecessary. I don't really know how much the regents themselves, all being new, really were aware of this in terms of the historical features of universities in the country generally. This same struggle has gone on in other states before. Michigan had been in the courts for years over who controls the university. But I simply hope that the regents do not sell out their right to govern the university as a separate corporate board. I think this would be unfortunate for the university. The university would be politicized like it's never been politicized before. And once things get politicized, they just become football. And that doesn't do education very much good.
Well, it's after the second.